Figure out a little bit about what exactly is the impact of the statement of the Gemara on the Vazvez, Al Yavazvez Yosin Yifomesh, and is it the same thing on Daf Nun and on Daf Samach Zayin? What is it in either place? And essentially, what have we seen so far? We've seen that we're not 100% sure if Daf Nun, which seems to be the main place in which it's recorded, at least as far as the Bavli is concerned, whether that's seen as referring to tzedakah or referring to mitzvos in general. And we mentioned the reason why you might say either way to the exclusion of the other. The Gemara on Daf Samach Zayin is clearly talking about tzedakah, but maybe it's a subset, or maybe it's even a different concept completely, which is something we can explore a little bit. So we also started talking about the Rambam, how the Rambam in Mishneh Torah uses the concept differently in different places. That in Hilchos Erechim Uchramim, there he really gets into saying don't spend more than a fifth, and that's a terrible idea, and what are you thinking, and what's wrong with you, and that's totally not the right thing to do, and you're not a chassid, and you're terribly making a mistake, and how much more can I say about how that's really not a good idea? And in Hilchos Matnas Aniyim, it has a different thrust to it, and it's presented actually as desirable. He doesn't say you should do more, but it sounds like maybe you could do more. But it sounds like the idea of chomesh is more of an aspiration, that this is an appropriate level of socket to give, while meiser is that of a bainim. That's an average kind of thing to do. Chomesh is better. And then he goes on to talk about Machsaro a little bit, and about what if you can only give Shusa Shekel, and how even an Ani should give something, things like that. So it seems like there are differences in his presentation of the Chomesh concept. It's also interesting to ask, before we come back to that point a little bit, so is there a clear sense of whether this is a prohibition, or is it maybe possible to read it as advice? That it's not kedai. When we talk about saying you shouldn't give more than a fifth, is it clear that that's something that we're not allowed to do? Or is it possible that it's advice? Listen, we don't want you ending up on the streets. We don't want you ending up taking stuff from others. So therefore, better not to give more than a fifth. What do you say about that? How did the Gemaras hit you on that point? Are you?
So Ali Basri sounds like a prohibition.
I could maybe go either way. I could see somebody reading that phrase by itself as either, you know, you shouldn't or you may not. But there is language in the Gemara, at least on Daf Nun, that's more like a prohibition by saying it was a takana. Right? So that seems like that's a prohibition, although there we've seen that maybe you could read that Gemara as talking about mitzvot specifically, and the Gemara in our parak as talking about something else. So it's possible maybe to read it as good advice in kind of the case of tzedaka and the prohibition in the case of mitzvos, if one divides the sugyas up that way. Rav Moshe Feinstein actually has a tshuva about this. This is in Chelek Yerideya, in Yerideya Chelek Aleph, in Siman Kuf Mem Gimel. At the very end, he has a paragraph about this, where he deals with this question. He's not 100% sure, is it an eitzah or is it a prohibition? And he suggests that our Gemara, actually, Samach Zayin, sounds like it's a prohibition, because if it was just good advice, so then the answer would have been obvious, that somebody giving away his money on his deathbed probably is not going to be subject to any problems of poverty. So therefore, if that's an issue, maybe it's a prohibition. And then the answer is, yes, it's a prohibition, but it's not an absolute across-the-board prohibition, and it makes space for somebody who's about to die to give away his money. I mean, one could perhaps argue a little differently. One could perhaps argue that the Gemara is saying that even when you're about to die, maybe it was bad advice, because maybe you should worry about the inheritors. Again, we'll talk about that, but there is, strictly speaking, a prohibition to disinherit your family. So I don't know if it's 100% conclusive from our Gemara that it's not also advice there. But in any event, the Ramah brings it, as you've seen, the Ramah brings it in the language of a prohibition. And the Rambam, it's really not clear. The Rambam doesn't really seem to bring it as a prohibition. And Hilchos Erech and Mekramim, he comes down hard on it more from a advice sounding perspective, this is the worst idea ever. And Hilchos Taka doesn't really talk about it at all as a limitation. So one way, I think, there's a lot written about the Rambam. We talk about, by the way, in terms of a prohibition, so I also mentioned, so we discussed yesterday that maybe as far as Staka is concerned, it's an internal logic matter, that it doesn't make sense to give away so much Staka that you yourself need to take Staka. And it doesn't necessarily present it as the same issue when it comes to mitzvos. But if you saw some of the additional makaris put on today, did anyone look at that? Did anyone look at the additional makaris today? If not, you'll see next time, see tomorrow morning, is an opportunity for those of you who are joining us this week. On Thursday, we normally do Parsha, but the Seder time is a little more flexible, so you could use the time to catch up on the Ma'amar Chumos tomorrow morning. So one thing that's interesting is the implication of a number of Makoros that when the Torah says, Efes Yevecha Elyon, that there should not be any poor among you, that there are those, as a Rashi actually sounds like this in a few places, and the Sefer Vid HaZav, which I think I already made some copies of to give out, in Parashas V'Aschana discusses this idea as well, that maybe there's a prohibition to allow yourself to descend into anius, that to whatever extent one is able to avoid the situation, maybe that actually presents itself in the Torah as an ister. The language of Efes, so the Gemara discusses it in the Masechet Sanhedrin elsewhere, that when the Torah says Efes, Dornish, what does that mean? Maybe it's a language of a prohibition. The Torah is not simply saying as a promise that there won't be any more poor among you, but saying that you should not allow yourself to become impoverished. And if that's the case, then maybe that creates its own kind of check on the notion of giving too much for tzedakah or spending too much for mitzvos. Yes.
So then what would be the purpose of making the takana? It would be bringing back that iser?
Or in order to, well, you don't know, it's absolutely going to reflect the iser. You know, it could be that somebody give away a fifth and not so quickly descend into poverty. So if you want to say it's takana is a straight rabbanan, so it could be in the spirit of a lot of the rabbanans that we think that there's a risk of this on the horizon, so we make an across-the-board policy, even though, as we'll discuss, it's not 100% across the board, but we make a policy that you shouldn't get too liberal with your spending because you could end up descending into poverty. So,
what if you have a lot of money?
Oh, so we do see, so we'll get later on to exceptions. One of the exceptions, Chavetz Chaim in Sefer Avos Chesed mentions, is that if a person is what's known as an usher muflot, and if a person is outstandingly wealthy, so clearly if a person is a mega billionaire, he can give away 99% of his money and not really risk being too poor. He'll still be richer than everyone else. So let's assume this is talking about a person who makes whatever the average income is. So the average income is such that there is an expectation of one-fifth, which is an interesting idea to consider also. Right? So why should that be? Is this something, presumably, that should maybe shift from society to society? Now, what does the idea mean to say that there's some type of continuing concept that the average earner in society has a fifth window, has a fifth margin before he starts becoming impoverished? How do we know that? Why don't we say that in every society, in every economy, it's going to be different? Especially if we trace this on some level back to Yaakov Avinu. Why would everyone stand that pasuk to me? So I think that's worthy of some thought. What's the idea that there's some type of a continuing notion that one-fifth is always going to be a relevant threshold before one goes too far into your ability to survive? So keeping that in mind, where does Meiser fit into all this? Right, it's also in some additional Ma'amar Chumos from today, so excuse me for going out of order. But what is the story with Meiser? So is Meiser a mitzvah? Is Meiser a chiyuv? What is Meiser? So just to say a few words about this, won't be able to go into every detail about it, but just so we have an idea of how it matches up with this. So the notion of Meiser Kachim is a highly recommended, wonderful practice on many, many different levels. The question is it a real din? Is it a din min ha-Torah? Is it a din mi-drabanan? Is it a minig? So just to give you a little bit of background, so that's somewhat of a debate. But the Behuda has a tshuva where he says that he's not comfortable talking about Meister Ksafim in a halachic sense, because there are no Gemaras about it. It's not something that has any real source in the Shas. Seems to be a later practice, so he's uncomfortable talking about it in a halachic sense. And the truth is, the only place we really see it in Chazal is the Tosfos in Tainus and Daf Tesamud Aleph, where Tosfos quotes a drasha from a Medrash. It's not clear whether this is a real drasha on a level in a Torah or not. That says that the uses the word kol, saying kol tuaz barecha, that all of your produce, that's not just the chi of maaser ani that we have in Eretz Yisrael for the produce that grows, but also all the other income that you make. He talks about the business income and the ribbis income, ribbis meaning, let's say, permissible ribbis, dealing with the non-Jewish businesses. So all of the income that you make, the Tosfos mentions the idea that you should give maaser of that as well. So if you read that as a real drasha, then you could say, right, there's a chi of min ha-Torah to give maaser ksafim. Most don't assume that that's the case. Most assume that it's not even a din d'rabbanan. You see, later they put on the list Bach and Taz about this. So there are some who maintain that, okay, it's not a real drasha min ha-Torah, but it's at least an asmachta. It's a din d'rabbanan. And many assume it's not even a d'rabbanan. It is a minig. And then when you talk about a minig, so there's different usages of minig. So sometimes we say minig, like Rabbi Simon Shlita just wrote the beautiful Sefer on Minhagim, that there's a concept of a minig that all of Klal Yisrael or huge segments of Klal Yisrael are obligated in. And sometimes we mean it differently. We mean that it's a hanhaga that you could take on yourself. So many assume that that's the case. When we talk about Maaser Ksafim, that it's not a deraisa or a drabbanan or a minig Klal Yisrael, but a minig that one can decide to take on. And that makes the shilas a little bit flexible, which is part of the issue that Noda Behuda was probably getting at. That, for example, if you ask, can Maaser Ksafim be used for all kinds of charitable causes that the IRS recognizes? Or are we talking about specifically for aniyim, for people who are poor? So if it's really a din min ha-Torah that's an extension of Maaser Ani, so then it really should be only for aniyim. It shouldn't be to support the yeshivas of the mikvah or anything else. While if it's less of a grounded din min ha-Torah, it's more of a minig, so then it could be more flexible. And especially if we say that it's a personal hanhaga, that it's something that you take upon yourself, so then all the more so that kind of leaves you the personal space to the autonomy to decide how you want to regulate it and what you feel that it could legitimately go for. That's one of the reasons why talking about this in an absolute halachic sense is a little bit difficult. Nonetheless, there are many contemporary truths about it anyway, but it's a little bit tricky to pin down as an absolute halachic concept. But let's assume that, okay, it exists as something. It exists as somewhere along the spectrum of recommended to obligatory behavior. So where do things fit in then? Right, so if you have Maaser, and then you have Chomesh, and you have more or less than that, so how do you relate to those things? What's the relationship between Maaser and Chomesh? And what is Chomesh as far as an upper limit, as far as an aspiration, as far as mitzvah and amukhar? How do you understand that? And also, what about the Yerushalmi? I wish many of you saw the Yerushalmi yesterday. So what sense do you get from the Yerushalmi? Does Yerushalmi sound like the Bavli in terms of how it presents this whole idea? Are you?
It's a positive command to be Mafresh HaChomesh.
Right, it sounds more like it's an aspiration. Right, and there you find the word L'mitzvah, right? Which is interesting, some of the Sfarim discussed, it could mean L'mitzvah, meaning that's how much you should spend on mitzvos, one of our possibilities here, or it could mean L'mitzvah in the sense of this is a good aspiration, that it would be a mitzvah to be Mafresh HaChomesh, to try to reach that level of one-fifth. So how could you understand how all these different elements come together? Maaser, Chomesh is an aspiration, Chomesh is a limit. You see any kind of a framework in which to put those together? Well, it could be, especially in light of what we've been saying, that maybe especially within the Rambam, that what if we say like this, that the concept of Maaser, however it plays itself out as far as level of obligation, but the notion of Maaser That is basically, again, to parallel Maaser Ani. So what does that mean? That means this is, it kind of goes with our V'ahavta Recha Kamocha category. That basically, we feel that the world should be sustained through Tzedakah. So when we have the concept of Maaser Ani, so what is Maaser Ani? Is Maaser Ani like a chesed? What does Maaser Ani fit into? So presumably, Maaser Ani is part of the Torah system in order to sustain the poor. And Maaser that goes to Levian is part of how the Torah has a system to support the Levian. And Truma, all of that is part of the basic economic structure that the world should have sustenance for the Aniyim, should have sustenance for the Levian and the Kohanim, etc., etc. So presumably Maaser Ani, as a continuation of that, is in the same category. Maaser Kesafim is in the same category. They were saying that we want there to be enough money for tzedakah, we want there to be enough for the Aniyim to be able to take from. So it makes sense that if we have everybody separate a tenth of their income as a basic minimum, so that will ensure a certain amount of tzedakah going into circulation. Now we have understood that our general De Machzoro idea is more about the giver. It's more about how you give tzedakah. So one could then perhaps argue, let's say again within the Rambam, that essentially when it comes to that, when it comes to a De Machzoro situation, right, if somebody's coming to ask you for tzedakah, so then really there's no limit. Right? As we've been discussing in the past weeks, you should really be trying to fulfill his De Machzoro. You should be trying to provide everything that this individual needs. So before we get to Chomesh, let's say we can say, listen, Maaser Kesafim, that's a basic recommendation as a minimum. If nobody is particularly coming to you and asking you, and there isn't any clear De Machzoro obligations in front of you, so then Maaser Kesafim is a good recommendation. But if there are Aniyim coming to you, if you have, let's say, some kind of clear scenario where De Machzoro was in front of you, so then forget about Maaser and do everything that you can in order to try to help them. However, we have a problem. That if we're going to really do everything that we can, so then you're going to become impoverished yourself. And that has a host of issues. On the one hand, it's not good advice because it's going to create a society where everybody is just cycling through poverty, giving to each other, and then becoming impoverished and taking from each other. So that's not so efficient. And maybe there is this inherent isser, if that's how you want to read it, from becoming impoverished, which is interesting, by the way, that Rashi that I was mentioning, Rashi in Bav Metzia and in Sanhedrin, is commenting on the din in the Gemara over there in the second parak of Bav Metzia, that even though you're obligated to return lost property, you have a mitzvah of hashavas aveda, but if, in order to attend to somebody else's lost property, you're going to have to neglect your own lost property, so you're going to end up losing your own things. So then the Gemara says, so shalcha kodem so l'shalcha deiro, that you have to first hold on to your own stuff before expending your effort to finding other people's stuff. So it's the same kind of idea as we find in tzedakah, that you have to make sure you don't become impoverished before giving tzedakah to others. And all of that's connected to this idea of Ephes, that there's a prohibition to let yourself totally fall apart financially. So we could say, then, that really, strictly speaking, when De Machzoro is there, you should be giving everything away. But we have the counterbalancing force that you should not let yourself become impoverished. And we have this notion here that a Chomesh is where that threshold is. So therefore, you shouldn't give more than a chomesh. And that's really a limitation on De Machzoro. That De Machzoro could mean give everything, but practically speaking, that's not a good idea, so give everything up to a chomesh. Right, so then it could make sense to say, so again, Maaser is when nobody's asking, when people are asking, infinite, which then gets cut off at the chomesh level. Now the fact that the Rambam presents it in Hilchos Matnas Aniyim really as more of a desired goal. If you think about it, it's perhaps particularly easy to see why it could be both at the same time, right? Why it could be the upper limit and the recommended amount, the mitzvah and the muftar, at the same time. Why? Why might you come to that conclusion?
Ideally, you probably do want to give more.
Mm-hmm.
Getting the desire would be the
same thing. Right, so that's definitely part of it. But the idea that we have this exact same number being invoked maybe in two conflicting directions, that this is your goal and this is your maximum. So how could it be both? It could be that that's actually the whole point. Right? That really you should be giving everything you can to Staka when there's a day machsaro need. When there's really a clear need in front of you, you should be giving everything necessary to fulfill that. But more than a chomesh is going to impoverish you. So therefore, going right up to that limit will represent the most you can do. So then that's mitzvah min hamufka. So you could perhaps see how it's both at the same time, that because it's the limit, that's where the mitzvah min hamufka is. So the Rambam is essentially saying that we would recommend that you give as much as you can without going too far into the threshold in which you're going to impoverish yourself. So in Hilchos Matnas Aniyim, he's saying, I recommend, give up to a fifth. That's really what would be the best thing to do. Average, everyone should give meiser, but the best everyone should do is to give up to a fifth. And elsewhere, he says that if you're volunteering, if you're being makdish to the Beis HaMikdash, something like that, Erech Nechramim, so then really you should be aware of your own sustainability, and to do more than a fifth is ill-advised. Shmuley was up first.
I'm going to say that. So that cheetah makes sense, but to say that would suggest that that's an exact like line in the sand we're drawing, basically.
Right.
But obviously, that's gonna mean that amount's gonna depend from person to person.
Right.
So that's drawing a line in the sand, like here it is, but this is for everyone. Like no matter how affiliated, make how what time period they live in, how much yeshiva tuition they have to pay, things like that.
Right.
It's kind of. Seems a little difficult to say.
So, but where's your question coming from? The question comes from the practicality or the question
of... No, just like being Masbiya the Rambam. Like,
right.
I'm just saying, it's not... If we want to say, oh, the Rambam's being a distinct line in the sand, it seems difficult to say, how can... It seems like it's difficult to just make a line in the sand like that.
Yeah, well, he could acknowledge all those differences, though, all those differences that you mentioned, you know, which is why it's not going to present itself as a chiyuv. But that the assumption being this rough rule of thumb, which clearly is given to a lot of deviation, but this rough rule of thumb that a fifth is what people can manage without going into poverty, so it makes sense perhaps that that line is both things, both the negative and the positive, that because that's where that line is roughly drawn, so you shouldn't go past it because you shouldn't put yourself in a position of poverty. But it's also the aspiration, because the notion that you're giving as much as you can without impoverishing yourself, that's perhaps the definition of mitzvah minimum. So, Sal?
But the Rambam might be saying that no matter how rich you or poor you are, if you go past the fifth, that's where you feel like you're poor. Meaning, like, for a rich person...
Assuming that he would extend this even to an usher, which I don't know if we know that. It is interesting, though, this idea, it seems to be, so to follow up what I was saying a few minutes ago, seems to be that there is a certain hashkafic belief here, that the idea of Meiser, to begin with, is the notion that a Kadosh Baruch Hu provides, and provides for you also to be a part of the tzedakah system of Klal Yisrael, so that the expectation is that for the average person, Meiser should be possible, and then the notion that Chomesh is an aspiration seems to be, especially if you root it back in Yaakov's declaration of Aser Asrenu, that that's a part of how HaKadosh Baruch Hu provides. The belief that in the average situation HaKadosh Baruch Hu provides for you, and that he provides for you the ability also to be a part of the chesed system. So therefore, to have that threshold, because it's really interesting otherwise, I think it's really worth thinking about what that means, especially considering the fact that since Meiser, as we said, doesn't really have a clear source in the Torah. Right? So it's really, if you think about it, the idea that the Gemara and Daf Nun finds one major lesson from Yaakov's statement. And without saying it's a din in the Torah, but still, you know, what is the lesson that the Gemara gets from that statement? What would you think? Just think about that. What would you think? So here, the Torah tells us that Yaakov says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm so impressed with the ladder and the angels and the whole story, and you're taking care of me, that everything you say, everything you give me, I will give you back a tenth. Right, so if I had to ask you, what's the impact of that statement? What's the lesson of the Doros? You know, what would you take away from it? You'd probably be more inclined to say it's a source for Meister. But the idea that the Gemara doesn't see that, the Gemara says that that represents kind of an upper limit, and that we can medayik in a double language in the pasuk to say it's 2/10, which means 20%, which means that's the upper limit. So it sounds like perhaps what Chazal were understanding here is that Yaakov is saying that Kadosh Baruch Hu, you provide for me, and I recognize therefore that I should then take from that and give back either as hekdesh or as staka, whichever it is, and that there's a certain threshold which is the line, and perhaps that line is by definition going to be both the ideal and the maximum at the same time. So whatever Yaakov was hinting at, that's the clue of generations. And that the Meiser idea is coming from a whole different place, which is a very fascinating idea. So now let's think about it for a minute. So we find that it's not clear whether Daf Nun is talking about staka or about mitzvos, but we know that l'halacha, the Ramah quotes it for mitzvos. Right? The Ramah is in Hilchos Lulav. And there, the Ramah tells us a couple of points of halacha. What does the Ramah say, practically speaking, from this Gemara? That mitzvos, one only has to spend up to a fifth. And he makes two distinctions. One distinction l'kula, one distinction l'chumra. Right, quoting from Rishonim. Now, what else does he say? He says that this even applies to one thing and doesn't apply to something else. What's that? Even applies to a mitzvah overet. Right? One might think that if a mitzvah is a rare opportunity, if it's Sukkot tomorrow, and this is your one chance to get an esrog until next year, it's not like some mitzvah which you can come back next week when you're a little bit in better financial shape. Still, there's no difference. And that's a discussion why that matters. You could say, okay, a mitzvah is a mitzvah anyway. What's the magic of a mitzvah overet? So there are Gemaras that seem to think that mitzvah overet has greater weight to it. So that's one of the ideas that the Ramah quotes from Rishonim, the quotes from the Rush in Bava Kamma, that not only mitzvahs in general, but even if it's an urgent mitzvah still, you're not obligated to spend more than a fifth. And what's the other half of the sentence? He says, but this doesn't apply to what? Sorry? Tulosase, right? It doesn't apply to lava. So there are many fascinating ideas, fascinating questions to ask in terms of how the concept translates now from staka to mitzvahs. For example, so when it comes to staka, so we said, okay, we understand it doesn't make sense to give staka in a way that impoverishes you. Now, by mitzvahs, it's not as self-evident. Right? So why would we say that mitzvahs have a limit that stops at one-fifth? Right? If it's not as inherently illogical, so why should we say that? What's the svara to say that mitzvahs, you don't have to spend more than a fifth?
Seems like the Gemara says that if you have multiple mitzvahs come before you, you're not going to be able to perform mitzvahs after because you're going to be out of money. And the Gemara regarding the shlish, it says if you get three mitzvahs coming before you, then you're going to have to...
Is that about mitzvahs, or is that basically saying... When the Gemara says that if you add up three mitzvos, then you add up to wiping out your whole estate, so is that Gemara trying to make the point that you won't be able to do any mitzvos? Or is it saying that ultimately the limit's meaningless because if you have enough mitzvos, there's no limit anymore because they'll just build on each other? It's probably more the second, but I think your point was going to be that maybe this is about protecting mitzvos. That if we say that you spend so uninhibitedly on mitzvos, you're not going to have anything left for mitzvos. But it's not clear that that would be the attitude to take, because maybe we'll say the mitzvah in front of you is more important. So right now, even if this is the last mitzvah you can do, why better you should be able to do that mitzvah, and instead of saying, don't do this mitzvah so that you can protect the future mitzvah. So what makes that later mitzvah any better than this mitzvah? So I don't know if it's about mitzvos. It could be that it's another reflection of this idea that there's some kind of iser to descend into anias. It could be some other things. What else could it be? What if it's not necessarily about a prohibition? So why else might you find that mitzvos have a limitation of one-fifth? What else could be the logic behind it?
Could you say similar to what you're saying, that this is Bein Adam Makom for the most part, and Hashem knows that if you may want to give more than a fifth, but it's kind of unnecessary to put yourself into that level.
So that's definitely a part of the equation, right? Definitely that Akash Baruch Hu, the Gemara is telling us that Akash Baruch Hu says, after a fifth, it's okay, I credit you anyway. But why does he let you off the hook after a fifth? So, you know, that part of the equation has got to be true, right? The guy says, okay, I understand. It's a thought that counts. But why does he indeed let us off after a fifth? So one approach could take is that this Gemara could be saying that maybe it's just too much to ask of somebody, that it's essentially psychically painful to have to give up such a chunk of your sustainability and to risk poverty. Maybe that's a form of tsar. And maybe we don't obligate you to undergo such tsar in order to fulfill mitzvahs. You could ask the question in general, how far do I have to go? Do I have to cut off my hand to perform mitzvah if that's necessary? Do I have to walk 100 miles barefoot in the snow, uphill both ways in the sweltering sun while being bitten by dogs? You know, what's the limit? How far do I have to go in order to perform mitzvah sase? It's a fair question to ask. If you have all kinds of other areas where there's a great challenge. And maybe that's what this Gemara is saying, that you're not obligated to undergo great tsar for a mitzvah. And this is where we draw the line. So maybe that's a way of saying that this is tsar. Too much of your financial bite is a tsar. And that's indeed how some Achronim interpret this Gemara, by the way. And some, and maybe we'll discuss a little bit more, we'll see if we get to it today. Some say that the thrust of Ksubas Daf Nun is that you don't have to either spend too much money or undergo tsar in order to fulfill mitzvos. That's the point. Another possibility, right, is that maybe if we want to save you, like we saw in the Hasala Gemara, that a part of it is we might want to save someone from having to go begging from door to door. So if you're going to spend all your money on the mitzvah, now you're going to have to go asking for money from other people. So that is going to put you in a position of begging. And we want to save you from having to beg. If that's the idea, so that might be rooted in another halachic principle. What might that be connected to?
Embarrassment.
Okay, so embarrassment, we talked about as a prohibition last week. So what's the related concept to embarrassment that's a halachic principle that overrides other dinim sometimes?
Kavod
Abrios. Right? So it could be that maybe this is an extension of Kavod Abrios. That basically the Gemara is saying that we're not going to put you in a position, if you want to fulfill the mitzvah of Esrog, so we're not going to put you in a position where you have to go begging, because that would be a violation of Kavod Abrios. Yes, sir?
Kavod Abrios is docha los haseis
mitar. Ah, so that's a good question. So what is the standard for Kavod Abrios? So that's the sugya which appears a number of times in Shas. But if you look, let's say, the first time it shows up in Brachos and Daf Yutes and Daf Chaf, so there the Gemara basically tells us that there are three things which Kavod Abrios wins out. That Kavod Abrios does not actually allow us to suspend a los haseis mitar Torah. But the Gemara first says that it does allow us to suspend the Drabbanan, that if you have a Kavod Abrios challenge to a Din Drabbanan, Kavod Abrios wins. And then the Gemara says that even in HaTorah, that if it's a passive violation of the Torah, so Kavod Abrios will win. So maybe that's what's going on here, that maybe essentially we're worried about compromising your Kavod Abrios. So that's a justification not to do a mitzvah. And maybe that's essentially what this Gemara is getting at. The third case that the Gemara says about Kavod Abrios is about Hashavas Aveda, that if returning the Aveda is going to require you to humiliate yourself, so you're not required to do it. So with that in mind, so let's consider the other chiluk that the Ramah has. So here the Ramah says that you're not obligated to spend all of your money on mitzvos, which, by the way, is probably not 100% agreed upon by Rishonim. You could find some Rishonim here and there who maybe disagree, but this is the way it's recorded in the Ramah. And it's probably not contradicted by major Rishonim in obvious ways. You have to be Medayik in a few less obvious places to find it. But the other half of the equation that it doesn't apply to Losa says, so that's not so obvious. What's the source of the Ramah's ruling that it doesn't apply to Losa says? What's the source in Shas? It's the Gemara in Brachos, actually, in the last parak of Brachos, where the Gemara darshins the pasuk in Kriya Shema, Rav Yehavta, Shem Lokecha, B'chol Avavcha, B'chol Nafshecha, B'chol Mo'odecha. So you have to love God with all of your soul, and all of your heart, and all of your Mo'odecha. So what does Mo'odecha mean? Mo'odecha sounds like it means all of your lots, all of your stuff, all of your possessions. So even if it means giving up all of your possessions, so then you have to still follow through. You have to still observe the Torah. So this is not agreed upon by everyone. With only Gaon, in his commentary to Maseches Avodah Zarah, to Hilchos Avodah Zarah rather, in Yerideya, in Kufnin Zayin, commentary to Hilchos Avodah Zarah. So the Gra understands, and a few others do as well, that they don't recognize this distinction between Aseis and Los Aseis. And they ask the question, which later Svarim address, that really that Gemara is talking about Avodah Zarah. That the Gemara is saying that if your Avos Hashem is at stake, if you're going to go turn to another god, if you're going to engage in idolatry, so that's Yehari Vayavur, B'chol Nafshecha, you have to give up your life. And B'chol Modecha, you should give up all of your money not to engage in idolatry. But maybe that shows us that it's not true by a typical Losa set, but by other prohibitions which are not subject to the notion of the Avodah Zarah's Chumrah, maybe it shouldn't apply. So there's some discussion whether or not the Ramah's distinction here is so agreed upon. The Torah Tanima quotes the Magen Avraham in Hilchos Shabbos, that the Magen Avraham says if you're out in the middle of the desert and somebody's going to come and rob you and take all your stuff and leave you with nothing, so then that could justify Chil Shabbos. So Torah Tanima says, you see there, it sounds like Magen Avraham is saying that even the Losa say of Shabbos, one could theoretically violate in order to save yourself from becoming completely bankrupt and having to give up everything that you have. Are you?
That Magen Avraham seems to be referring specifically to Darabanan type things, like traveling in a caravan.
Maybe. It's not 100% clear, maybe. But let's assume for a second that it's not the case. So one might see from there a difference between him and the Ramah, even though we'll see that Rabbanan is not clear that that makes a difference. And we'll talk about that in a second. But whether it's Dereises or Rabbanan, so there he's talking about Los Ases. So if that's the case, is that a raya against the Ramah's position? That he disagrees with Ramah's position? Maybe not. Rav Shechter has pointed out that not so obvious, because maybe there the Magen Avraham is saying that that's a pikuach nefesh situation. That if you're stuck in the middle of the desert with nothing, so it's going to be harder for you to survive. So it's not about your money, it's about your life. It's saying that that's a situation of pikuach nefesh on Shabbos, that you can't be left with nothing. But one could also say that maybe he's saying that in general that's true, that anybody who's left without any resources is always at greater risk of his life. And therefore, this could be true in general, that you shouldn't have to give up your entire possessions for any mitzvah. So there's some debate about whether or not the Ramah's distinction is true. But if it is true, so how could we explain it? Why should that be the case? Why should it be that for mitzvos, you only have to spend a fifth, but for losa says you have to give up everything? So where else do you find such a distinction in halacha? I think there's a total of three places. Where else do you find distinction between positive mitzvos and negative mitzvos? As far as, or positive behavior and negative behavior. Okay, that's interesting in terms of clashing against each other. But what I was actually looking for is where do you find halachos that distinguish, that some they apply only for positives but not for negatives? So there are probably three such categories. One is the Gemara towards the end of Yevamos for the recent Daf Yomi people, where the Gemara says Yesh kolach b'dei chachamim v'akor dover min ha-Torah. V'shei v'al-tasa. It's the Gemara daf ketes and daf tzadi and yivamos. Right, so we say that Chazal can suspend Torah law in order to protect the other mitzvos. So they can tell us not to blow shofar on Shabbos, but they don't tell us to eat treif or to be mechal Shabbos. They tell us not to do mitzvos. So the conclusion of the Gemara is they can tell us not to do positive mitzvos, but they can't tell us to do averos. Question about that? So that's one case. Another case you mentioned a few minutes ago is Kavod Abrios. That Kavod Abrios suspends even Torah law if it's a matter of not doing a mitzvah, but doesn't allow you to do an aver. And in that case, the Gemara quotes a pasuk. Pasuk in the Mishnah says, "Ein eitza v'ein chachma v'ein tfuna l'neged Hashem," that there is no counsel or wisdom or understanding in opposition to God. So the Gemara says, "B'makom chil Hashem ein cholkin kavod l'gad." But if it's a chil Hashem, if you're going to do something active against the Torah, so then your covenant doesn't rank against God's covenant. But if it's passive, if you're simply going to skip a mitzvah, so then Kavod Abrios can override it. So you have Kavod Abrios, and we have Akira Dabam and HaTorah. And those are both Gemaras. Right? The Gemara in Yevamos about Akira Dabam and HaTorah, and the Gemara in Brachos about Kavod Abrios. And then this would be the third. It's not a Gemara, it's a Ramah. But this might be the third area in halach in which you find such a distinction drawn. So it would work very well, actually, if we say that one is based on the other. If we say this distinction is based on Kavod Abrios, like you said a few minutes ago, so that would fit in very neatly. And it could be that we're not obligated to give up all our money for mitzvos, because that would be a violation of Kavod Abrios, and Kavod Abrios suspends positive mitzvos. So therefore, it would fit very nicely that we're not obligated to perform positive mitzvos if it's going to impoverish us. But for Losa says this wouldn't apply. Okay.
Doesn't this seem like a grama for Kavod Abrios? Meaning you're not, by spending more than a fifth, you're not automatically going to be poor.
Correct.
And so there's not automatically a Kavod Abrios problem going toward the door. It's really much more removed.
Right, which may be why it's a takana specifically and not inherently there. Right, the idea, maybe, if you assume that Chazal then got involved and said, okay, this is going to put you at the doorstep of a Kavod Abrios issue, so therefore don't go that far, maybe it reflects the idea that when it's full-blown Kavod Abrios, so then we have this existing in halacha. So we also put into the system that you shouldn't come up to that threshold. So in all three areas of halacha, we have this distinction, Kavod Abrios and Akiras Davar and HaTorah and spending money on mitzvos. So you find Achronim, in each case, asking the same question. Are we talking about classification, something which is classified as a mitzvah saseh as opposed to a mitzvah lo saseh? Or are we talking about behavior, that you can't do active things against the Torah, but you can do passive things. You can do what's called in English a crime of omission rather than a crime of commission. So maybe that's the idea. Is it about behavior then, or is it about classification? So in each one of these areas, you find Svarim discussing this question. So for example, in our sugi here, the Bikuri Yaakov in Hilchos Lulav has a whole discussion about this. The Bikuri Yaakov was written by Rebecca Bettinger, who was the Rebbe of Rav Shamshon of Bal Hirsch, who also wrote the Sefer Aruch Haner. So he poses this question, what are we talking about? This whole distinction, the Ramah's distinction. Is he talking about positive mitzvos versus negative mitzvos, or is he talking about behavior that you're allowed to just act passively, but if something requires you to get up and do something against the halacha, then you have to spend all of your money. So for example, let's say you have to delay a funeral. Right, so delaying a funeral is a passive act. You're just not having a funeral until later. But what is the language the Torah uses to tell you not to delay a funeral? Lo salim. And you should not let it wait around. So on the one hand, it seems like it's a lo saseh. However, one violates it passively. So what category is that? So how would you decide whether it should be about behavior or whether it should be about classification. Why should you make one distinction or the other? So it could be that the whole question here is, why are we distinguishing in the first place? Why are we assuming that say is yes and los say is not? Or omission yes and commission not? Why are we assuming like that? So one way to look at it is to say that, well, we know in halacha that mitzvahs asay are always less severe. Not doing a mitzvah asay is always a less severe offense than committing a los asay. How do we know that? What's the indication that's true? Why should you,
There's no asay. There's very few asays where you can get the death penalty for.
Yes, there are certainly very few. Basically, it's about onshin. Right? That if we have a system that we assume that different onshin reflects severity, that an avera that has a bigger onish is a more severe avera, so then that seems to put all positive mitzvos on one side of the river and all negative mitzvos, or most negative mitzvos, on the other side. Because the mitzvos asay in the Torah, with two exceptions, don't have any onish associated with them. So if it's all assessed based on onish, so you could say that all of the los asays are more chumer than all of the asays. So maybe it's about severity. That's an approach many have. Many assume that skipping an asay is less of an offense against the Torah, is less severe than committing an asay.
Well, I mean, the psychological aspect of that is that if someone doesn't do something good, it's much better than if they do something bad. So obviously you're going to punish someone more for doing something bad than for just simply missing the opportunity to do something good.
Okay. Yes, very well put. And to illustrate your point a little bit further, that if there are those who ask, and this whole assumption, this whole idea that we have that asays are less severe, which the proof from punishment is a pretty good proof, right? We do assume that punishment correlates to severity. So the fact that there's no punishment for mitzvahs asay does seem to suggest that it's less severe. So some ask, well, there is a contradiction to this. There is a principle in Shas, which somebody mentioned a few minutes ago, which seems to say that observing asays is more important than not violating los asays. What's that principle? What about that principle that the Gemara says that if I have to choose, if I have a clash between a mitzvah saseh and not committing a los saseh, I should perform the mitzvah saseh even though I will be violating a los saseh? So how does that square with the idea that violating a los saseh is a bigger offense than missing an saseh? It sounds like it's more urgent for me to perform the mitzvah saseh. And the Ramban, in his commentary to Chumash, the Ramban says the reason for asay dochalos asay is that asays are reflective of avas Hashem. You love God, so you do active things for Him. While los asays, abstaining from averos, that is a function of yiras Hashem. You revere and fear God, so you stay away from averos. So, if you want to choose a value, you have a clash between Avos Hashem and Yiras Hashem. So, Avos Hashem, that's a more important value. You'd rather take that opportunity to express your Avos Hashem than to express your Yiras Hashem. So, how do you square that idea with the notion that los asays are more chamer? So, this is essentially what Adin was just asking. That there's an approach I saw once in a Sefer. A sefer happened to be called Sheila Shol, written by Shol Breitsch, who was the son of the Chalkas Yaakov Breitsch, if you want to know who he was. So he writes, which I think a little bit Adin was getting at this, that the two ideas do work together, that essentially what the Ramban is saying is that it's a bigger accomplishment to fulfill a mitzvah saseh than it is to avoid a los saseh. In other words, if you want to take a poll of the population, how many people stay away from los asays? And how many people not only stay away from los asays, but even do positive mitzvahs? So presumably there are fewer people who also do positive mitzvahs, because, okay, to not do an isser, everyone will stay away from an isser. But to do a positive mitzvah, that's a greater level of accomplishment. So in other words, asay docha los asay, because it's a greater accomplishment to be able to express your avos Hashem than your yiras Hashem. But that itself shows you that somebody can't even observe a los asay, that's a very low level. So maybe we'll say that that's what the distinction here is, that, okay, so you can't perform mitzvos, they're too expensive, okay. But to allow you to do averos to save money, that to save all of your money, that's too much. That's past a certain line that we can't cross. What are you, okay? So that might be one way to look at it. It might be about chumrah. In which case, then maybe it should distinguish between ases and los ases. Alternatively, one could say that it's not about chumrah, but it's simply about behavior. That to actively do something against the Torah that's visible, whether we classify it as an asay or a los asay, but to actively do that, that's called a chil Hashem. And that much we can't allow. We have to go to great lengths to avoid a chil Hashem. But if you're simply acting passively, so we don't see that there's any behavior here against the Torah, regardless of whether it's classified as an asay or a los asay, that's not as bad. That's simply a missed opportunity. And therefore, just like Kavanah Brios could allow that, so maybe too, this spending limitation could be extended to that as well. So this is a big discussion in Poskim, whether you say that when we apply this distinction, do we apply it based on behavior, or do we apply it based on classification? So for example, many discuss the questions, an essay about this in the Sefer Marcheshes. Many others talk about this. Let's say somebody comes and tells you they need life-saving surgery. So they ask you for money to pay for the surgery, which is probably pretty expensive. So why aren't you obligated to give all of your money to save them? Because to not jump in and save someone, isn't that a violation of a law, right? Which law? Losam el dam reyecha. So why don't we say, okay, that's a los asay. You have to give up all your money to avoid a los asay. So you should have to turn over everything every time somebody needs a surgery, which there's always people who need. So that itself is a question. But if you say that, no, this is categorized as an asay, because even though the Torah uses negative language, but it's something you do actively or passively, if you violate losamo just by not doing anything. So therefore, it's categorized like a mitzvah asay. You could also ask the question, what about, so to focus on our stukah sugis, right, so what is stukah? Mitzvah asay or los asay? It's an asay, but?
It has a
low sase. It has two low sases, right? Like as we saw from day one, right? Tosfos notes that it has the low sases of low sikvos and low samets. So why don't we say that we should view staka as a low sase? And therefore say this whole gemara should be thrown out. You have to spend all of your money on staka because it's a low sase if you don't do it. So there could be a couple of answers to this. As we saw, we talked about what exactly are the circumstances when you violate those low sases. But you could also say that whenever the Torah has a mitzvah saseh and a lo saseh together, and that essentially the impact is do this and don't not do this, that really that's called a mitzvah saseh. That we read the lo saseh as essentially strengthening the aseh, and we categorize the whole thing as a mitzvah saseh. This was a comment the Maratz Chayas makes in his commentary in the back of the Gemara in Maseches Sukkah. Because to mention another area of halacha, or maybe we should distinguish, we have a concept called Osek Mitzvah Tatim and HaMitzvah. Right? That if you're involved in one mitzvah, so you're not obligated to stop that mitzvah and do other mitzvahs. So the Maratz Chayas in Maseches Sukkah, where that Gemara appears, so he says, it seems to him intuitively obvious, even though the Gemara doesn't say it, but it seems to him intuitively obvious that that only applies to mitzvahs asay. Right? Would you ever hear somebody say that, okay, I'm involved in a mitzvah so I can eat treif? Right? It's a good deal, right? It's a good way to get people to do more mitzvahs if you're curious about what the White Castle little hamburgers taste like. So it's a good deal. So why don't we say that? Right? Why don't we say that if you're involved in a mitzvah, you're pater from the prohibition of eating bas v'chalav? Because he assumes it's intuitively obvious that it only applies to mitzvahs aseh. It means you don't have to do active mitzvahs. If you're involved in one mitzvah, you don't stop that mitzvah to do other mitzvahs. But clearly it doesn't allow you to do prohibitions. That just would not seem to make sense. So then, based on that premise, he says, how come there is a Gemara that seems to say that Osek b'mitzvah will pater you from stucker? Now, without going into details of the Gemara now, because we're going to run out of time, but the Gemara seems to say that if somebody asks you for stucker and you're involved in a mitzvah, you don't have to stop that mitzvah to provide stucker. So says Maratz Chayes, I don't understand. According to Tosfos and Ksuvos, refusing stucker is a los aseh, two los asehs. So if you're not going to be excused from los aseh because you're involved in a mitzvah, you're not allowed to eat treif or be machal Shabbos because you're involved in a mitzvah, so why should you be excused from stucker? So many Achron and Stipler and many others have a principle, it's based on Ramban actually, that any time a negative mitzvah seems to clearly be there in the Torah to protect a positive mitzvah, that the impact is do this mitzvah and don't not do this mitzvah, that we treat that like a mitzvah saseh for all intents and purposes. So this, for example, may also be the answer that we have a din, you have to pay your workers on time, b'yomo titen scharo, but you're not obligated if you don't have enough money. Going to wipe you out, you're not obligated. So you could ask, well, wait a minute, there's a los aseh in the Torah, right? Los salin kulas achir. So you have to give up all your money not to violate a los aseh. So it could be, this is another example of an aseh that's backed up by a los aseh, so we treat it like a mitzvah aseh. So all of that could be relevant to understanding how exactly this distinction comes up. What the Rama is telling us when he says for practical mitzvahs we have such a distinction. We have a few other points we need to add, but we're just about out of time. We have to also talk about the question which Ari was asking or alluding to before about does it make a difference whether we're talking about the Raisas or the Rabbanon. We have to figure out where exactly Pirshumei Nisa fits into this, which we alluded to yesterday. And are there other exceptions? So we have a few more points that we have to fill in. So, God willing, we'll do that, and then we'll move to other sugya pretty soon here, after Chazara. When's the midterm slot? So, probably the dividing line between the Stucker sugyas and the Gittin sugyas will probably Chazar and figure that out, so that's on the horizon. But so just to quickly review what we spoke about today, and then we'll dab mincha, and tomorrow is Parshas Truma. But so we spoke about essentially trying to figure out again the scope of what is Chomesh and what is Meiser. So we spoke a little bit about what Meiser is practically. Is Meiser din daraisa, like Tosfos sounds like, or the Drasha midrabanan or Asmachta, or is it a minig klal Yisrael, or is it, like many assume, a minig in the sense of a personal anhaga, which also affects what is it applied to. If it's a din min haTorah, it should be like Meiser ani, and only go for aniyim. If it's a din darabanan, it could be a little bit more flexible, and if it's a personal anhaga, it really would be based on how you take it on. And we tried to figure out what's exactly the place of Meiser and Chomesh and the aspiration versus limitation. And suggested that maybe the Meiser, that's a general policy in order to make sure there's stucker for everyone. But when you have Dei Machsoro, somebody's asking you for the legitimate Dei Machsoro need, really it should be then everything that he needs. However, we're worried about Anius, so because of Anius, so we have an externally imposed limitation of Chomesh. But that could also at the same time be the aspiration, because maybe that's the point that you should dafka be at the line, go as far as you can without impoverishing yourself, so that would be about a Chomesh. And we talked about, it's interesting how this seems to be the expectation throughout the generations and throughout the societies, that there will always be this Chomesh, so perhaps that's a hashkafic statement of how we expect God to provide in the general sense, and that provision should include this possibility of being a part of the sustenance of others and a part of the stocker system. And then we talked about the fact that the Rama applies our Gemara to mitzvot, whether or not that's what the Gemara means by itself, but he applies it to mitzvot. We talked about why should it apply to mitzvot. Is it about not going into Aeneas, we talked about the fact that Rashi in a few places in the Rivadazar discusses a prohibition of going into Aeneas. So is it about that? Or is it about that this represents a certain level of tzar and you're not obligated to undergo tzar for mitzvos? Or is it about kavod avrios, that this will be a kavod avrios situation if you become impoverished and kavod avrios suspends some areas of halacha, so here it works as well. And then we discussed, in general, the areas of halacha where you find distinction between aseis and los aseis, as the Rambam makes the distinction. We discussed that not everyone acknowledges the distinction. There's only going for one doesn't acknowledge the distinction. It says the Gemara in Brachos is talking about avodah zarah specifically, therefore general los aseis doesn't apply, but assuming that you have the distinction, so what's it based on? So we noted, first of all, you find distinction here, and by Akira Stavrimina Torah, and by Kavod Abrios. And we said, in general, this connects to a question of what is the real standard. Is it mitzvah saseh versus lo saseh, or is it passive behavior versus active behavior? And then the question is the assumption that aseis are less chumer than lo saseh. We discussed that that could be squared with aseh docha lo saseh. And if it's about behavior, then maybe it's about a chil Hashem. When you're actively doing something wrong, it's a chil Hashem, however we classify it. But if you're not actively doing it, then that's more tolerable, regardless of whether it's a say or a los say. And then we discuss this question of what about cases where the Torah has a dual system, where it has assays and los assays, like Sukkah seems to be such an example. So many Achronim assume that it's just an enhancement of the assay, and it's treated as an assay. And we found the Maritz Chayes making a similar comment in the context of Oseg Mitzvah Patam and a Mitzvah, where just intuitively it makes sense that that should only apply to positive mitzvahs and not to negative mitzvahs. And yet we find it applied to tzedakah, so he asserts this idea that there the lavin come to support the mitzvah saseh, so it's going to follow the policies of the mitzvah saseh. Any question on any of that? Some of that is a little complicated. Any issues? Any observations? Any attacks? Any disagreements? Any enhancements? Any, okay, so we'll stop there. We'll dav milchah again. Okay.